I'm fantasy and romance author Leslie Penelope, and this is Imagining Success, an interview series where I talk to authors who have achieved career milestones others only dream about and ask them how they got there and where they go from here. In this episode, I get to speak to the legendary romance author, Beverly Jenkins. Ms. Bev is best known for her historical romance novels that shine a light onto African-American history. But she also writes contemporary romance, romantic suspense, and young adult titles. Through her work, countless women of color have been able to see themselves on the page, falling in love in time periods and scenarios that are deftly researched and have created an army of loyal readers. She's the recipient of the 2017 Romance Writers of America Nora Roberts Lifetime Achievement Award, as well as the 2016 Romantic Times Reviewer's Choice Award for historical romance. I was beyond thrilled to be able to talk with Ms. Beverly Jenkins. Here's our conversation. Welcome, Beverly Jenkins, to my imaginary friends. I'm so happy that you are here.
Oh, thank you for the invite. I see you got on my shirt.
I love it. I'm wearing the Slayer of Words shirt. Get these from the Smart Bitches website. And yeah, I was there for that speech when this was coined.
Oh, okay.
That was a great moment.
That was fun. That was a lot of fun. I got my Black Authors Matter hat
on.
Oh,
nice. Yes.
Got that from, what is her name? Gwen. Down in Houston.
Oh, nice.
Who does the Black Book Fair down there. So, yeah. All right. I'm going to shut up. Let you get started.
I just wanted to start out before publishing. Why did you start writing in the first place?
I began writing, elementary school. Always had a love for words. Mm-hmm. I was the editor of my elementary school newspaper, The Comet, at Jones Elementary on the east side of Detroit. But it was not something that I had planned to do as a life goal. Mm-hmm. All I wanted to do was work in a library, probably because there were books there. But I scribbled and scribbled and scribbled through junior high and high school. And I think she might have been my 11th grade teacher, a woman named Linda Berkowitz. I still remember her name. Had us do a short story one day in class. And when she turned them back to us a couple days later, she made me stay after class for a minute. And she said she wanted to enter the little story that I had written in a citywide contest. And I'm like, so, you know, being 15 or whatever, and not having a whole lot of confidence in much of anything, you know, except ruling my six brothers and sisters. I respectfully declined. She was very, very disappointed. Oh. But at that point was when I knew I could write. Mm-hmm. But it was still not a life goal. And maybe it was because, you know, when you grow up, you know, the way I did in the 60s, and life is more than enough for you to handle on a regular basis. You don't see writers. And a lot of times you can't be what you don't see. Mm-hmm. I did a little event down in, where was I, Mississippi? This was 6 or 7 years ago, maybe a little bit longer. But anyway, it was a library lunch. And what they did was they had, you know, lunch, which was good for the people who attended. And then they had people like me on the stage, you know, talking and answering questions. And afterwards, I'm signing books outside of the venue, and they had invited a bunch of high school kids. And these were all, you know, young Black kids, high school. And one of the young women was in tears. And, you know, me being as sensitive as I am, I'm like, you know, baby, why are you crying? You're going to have me crying. I don't even know why you're crying, right? And she said she had always wanted to be a writer, but she had never seen one before. Mm. And it touched her so much that she was in tears, you know, and I just, you know, I'm a hugger. So, you know, I just pulled her in and said, baby girl, you can be whatever you want to be in this world.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes our kids, meaning, you know, kids of color, don't get to see sometimes what they aspire or what their dream is.
Yeah.
So me not having, you know, like I said, being 15 and no confidence outside of my own little bubble. When she asked me to, I was like, nah, you know, I'm cool.
That can be really powerful. I did my first school events recently, I think in November. Okay. And I spoke at a middle school and a high school, and I'm doing some more. And it is amazing to see kids. And these are kids, I'm in Maryland, so they're in Southeast DC, which is, they have this program that kind of brings in authors and Black authors to speak to them. And just seeing them meet an author and, you know, we're still celebrities to them. And it's,
right.
You know, I feel a little jaded, but it is really powerful to connect with someone who loves reading and who never imagined that they could be a writer also.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I at the beginning of my career, I did a ton of school stuff. And one of the things I always ask when we do, after I got through doing whatever it was we did, I asked the kids, what are your dreams? You know, and nobody had ever, even the teachers were surprised. They were like, we never thought, you know, because, you know, now schools are different than they were when we were growing up, when I was growing up. And the things that these kids said, and some of them had no, you know, and also one of the things I told them was like, you don't laugh at somebody else's dream. So, you know, our kids dream, but society in a lot of places doesn't allow them to think that could be a reality. So,
Yeah. So it doesn't seem like, well, it was writing part of your identity, even though you didn't necessarily have the confidence, or do you think that came later?
The writing was part of my identity, but it was my private identity.
Okay.
I was a storyteller to my sisters, or three of us in a bedroom. And at night, I would tell them stories. And looking back, it was fan fiction because, you know, it was set in this big old house and there were Motown people in there and Star Trek people and, you know, the man from Uncle people and, you know, and all of these people interacted, you know, and there were love stories and all of this. And it got to the point where, you know, we would hurry up and do our chores. So we would go to bed early, which, you know, freaked my mother out, so they could hear the next episode, you know. So so all of that and the fact that, you know, I love to read put me where I am now. You know, like I said, my dream was to work in a library, and I had achieved that. And but sometimes life hands you stuff and says, here, put this hat on. See how you like this. Mm-hmm. Because I hadn't planned on being published at all. So here we are.
Yeah. So what was the leap between, you know, writing privately and then seeking to become published, to have it more public?
It was a challenge from a woman that I worked with. She, I was working at the library at Parke Davis Pharmaceuticals, which is probably maybe one of the real first of the big firms. They started in Detroit back in the, I don't know, who knows how old they are. But anyway, I was at the reference desk and she wrote romance. My friend Laverne Cohen, we're still friends today, 30 years later. And she had just gotten published with a sweet publisher, a little small press. Not too far from where we were and where Parke Davis was in Ann Arbor, Michigan at that time. And we were celebrating her. And I told her about this little manuscript I was working on, just as an aside, not. And so she said, well, you bring it in, so let me read it. And so I brought it in, and it was something that I had been working on just for me after work. You know, back when I was God, this was meant to be 76. And I was working at the Michigan State University Library. My husband and I had been hooked up for about 5 years. And he would go, he played tennis in high school. This is a long story. He played tennis in high school. And he would come home from work and go play tennis. Mm-hmm. And I was working at the university library at that time. And I would come home and bring whatever I had snuck out of cataloging, you know, and I would write on this story that eventually would become Night Song. Because I'd always loved love stories, even when nothing in the larger media represented us, people mm-hmm. of color. So I would scribble on this and, you know, la, la, la. So anyway, this is the manuscript that I gave to Laverne 10 years later. And she said, she came back the next day. She said, you really need to get this published. And I'm like, where? Because this is like 87, maybe 89 or so. And, you know, and the market was closed to us for mm-hmm. mass market.
Right.
Except for, you know, occasional people. And I tell folks that she harassed me every day. Bless her heart. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, I'm a firm believer that the universe or God or whoever the creator is puts stuff in your life when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a subscription, I think, to Romantic Times back then. And the only person that I had seen of color was Vivian Stevens.
Right.
Okay. So some kind of way, and to this day, I have no idea how I got Vivian's contact information. But I sent her my little raggedy manuscript just to shut Laverne up. I knew that this was after Vivian had left Harlequin and she had a small literary agency. And so, like I said, I had no idea how I got in touch with her. But anyway, I sent it to her. And less than, I want to say 4 or 5 days later, she called me at the desk because I had given her the work number and the house number. And she said she wanted to represent me. And I was like, oh, shit. Okay. You know, and out of that came Night Song, which was the first mm-hmm. book. Avon bought it in 93. It was published in 94. So this will be its 30th year.
Wow, yeah.
And my 30th year as a published author. So
wow.
It's been a blessing.
Yeah. So when you get the call from Vivian Stevens.
Yeah.
As it was coming, like as you were on submission or when it was first being published, do you remember what you thought success would be? Like, what were your hopes for it?
I didn't care.
Okay.
You know, because like I said, I had no plans. Being published was not a dream of mine.
Mm-hmm.
All I ever wanted to do was work in the library. And that's what I was doing. So the hundreds, that's my number, of rejections that I got didn't mean anything to me because I was getting up every morning and living a dream. I was going to work in the library every morning, you know. So now, granted, had I been looking to be published, I'm sure all of the rejection letters would have broken my heart.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I don't care. You know, I was living my dream. I didn't care anything about that. But then on June 3rd, 1993, and I told a story at one of the events about this fight my husband and I were having that day. And in the middle of the fight, the phone rang. And it was Ellen Edwards, who's executive editor at Avon. And she wanted to buy my book. So I was like, okay, time out on the fight. And that's where the journey began, you know, and a year later. And that was his birthday, too, June 3rd.
Oh.
So, yeah, my biggest supporter. Miss him dearly. But it took off from there. And they kept sending me contracts and I kept sending them books. And So, like I said, 30 years later, here we are, you and I.
So 30 years later, why are you still writing? Has it become? Yeah.
It's my dream now. You know, I mean, I didn't realize how many stories I had inside of me. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed the process. I enjoyed. Yeah, you enjoy seeing your stuff in a store, mm-hmm. you know. But it was the reaction of the readers that really touched my heart. Because nobody had written historicals before. I mean, we'd had contemporary with Rosalind Wells and Sandra Kitt and Brendan and them when they were writing for, oh, I can't think of the, it'll come to me, before Arabesque. Mm-hmm. So the idea that not only was I getting published, but people were writing me letters about how much they loved the stories and what it did for their self-esteem and all of that. And I was like, okay, well, here's the next book, you know. So, you know, and back then it was one book a year. Mm-hmm. So you had time to devote as much love and affection and work as it needed for them to be, you know, stand out in the market, whether, you know, the white media embraced it or not. Mm-hmm. The women of color of all stripes, not just black women, began to see themselves in places that they'd never seen themselves before on the page and in situations that they'd never seen themselves before on a page. So it was a win-win for me and a win-win for them. And mm-hmm. And it's like that, what is that Oscar Wilde quote? If I don't write, I go mad. Mm-hmm. So it got to be that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've had a great ride. I've had a great ride.
And I mean, it's not too much to say that you are a beloved author among your readers and other authors, especially Black authors, Black romance authors, mm-hmm. you know, and so... I know that the feedback, you have a really close relationship with your readers.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel that, kind of come back in terms of what their expectations? Does that weigh on you at all when you're writing, if you're thinking about them?
No, the expectations come within me. Mm. I tried very, very hard not to write the same book twice. I try very, very hard to represent the history in a way that we can all be proud. Mm-hmm. I like to show whose shoulders we stand on, because none of us would have gotten here without,
right.
you know, those folks that came before. It's like Dorothy Sterling was in her book, We Are Black, we are your sisters, Black women of the 19th century. And she said Black women had three gifts in the 19th century, which is why we were basically successful back then. We worked, whether we were enslaved or free. We had a commitment to community and social activism. And number three, we pushed the envelope on gender and race. And if you think about that, we're all doing that still.
Yeah.
You know, and all of my heroines, you know, without me even thinking about it, have come to me with one, two, or three of those gifts. So it's my respect for the Black women. It's my respect for the community. It's my respect for my mama, who was Black before it was fashionable, who, you know, raised me with Black history in the home. So it's something that I didn't know I had to do, but it became that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you feel like this is the purpose? I mean, all three of those things are evident in your work, definitely. And I see that. And yeah. It really resonates with me as well. I mean, does this work feel purpose-driven?
Yeah. This is my ministry.
Yeah.
You know, this is, you know, the gospel that I try and spread.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when to know that, because I'm on my fourth generation of women now, I think. You know, from the teen books through, you know, their mamas through their mamas through the old hands like me, right? So the idea that our history is now resonating with more women than we can probably count is a good thing for our history, and it's a good thing for the race. Because once you learn something, they can't take that from you.
Right.
I always give the example of one of my ladies. Her grandson had to do a Black History report. And, you know, in schools, there ain't but five Black people in Black history. And I don't remember whether he did his report on Bass Reeves or the Cowboys or the Whalers in New England. But anyway, the teacher was blown away by his report. And she asked him, "Where did you get this information?" And he said, "My grandmama's Miss Bell books." That brings tears to my eyes.
It should be a source, a primary source for
And you know, and I have one woman who's doing her PhD in history, American history. And she's telling the professor, I don't know what they were discussing, but she was telling the professor about the Great Exodus of 1879, which is, you know, connected to Night Song and the Blessing Series and all of that. And he told her she was making that up.
What?
He told her, he told her, you must be confusing that with the Great Migration of 1900. And she's like, no. You know, this is the very first movement of Black people out of the South after the gutting and Reconstruction. He told her. So she told me, she said, "Luckily, Miss Bell, you have sites in the backs of your books."
Right? Yes.
And she said, so I sort of slapped him with those. And I said, well, how did he react to having to eat crow with his foot in his mouth? She said, I got to be in the class.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. She said, probably because she said, I should have gotten that A. But
yeah.
But so it's a revolutionary kind of thing also in that, you know, not only are my readers learning, but the people that they come in contact with are learning about, you know, our history and how deep and strong our roots are here in this country. So, yeah, I'm pretty proud of that.
In terms of success in the publishing industry, you know, wow. With the things that are kind of stacked up and the things that I'm sure that you've seen and been through those three decades in the publishing industry, that has to affect your kind of goals or where you think the books can go or does it? Does that?
Well, it does in the sense that I have never made New York Times.
Right.
Okay. But through these books, I feel like I'm connected to every Black woman in this country. And that's a different kind of success.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. That's a different kind of success, which is probably more valuable in the long run for your spirit than it is for seeing your name on a list. Yeah, I'd love to make a list, but it's okay. You know, I'm making lists everywhere all the time. There are women. You know, that's one of the great things about Twitter that has now become such a hellhole. There are women discovering my books every day. Yeah. You know, and it's just amazing to me. You know, on one hand, I'm like, where you been? You know? You know how long I've been out here? You know, and then on the other hand, you congratulate them for you know, being new members of the family. Mm-hmm. Especially those women who never read historicals before. You know, and the sense of self-worth that the books can sometime supply. Mm-hmm. So success can be measured in myriad ways.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's really important and really powerful because, you know, thinking about my own ideas of success in this industry and how they're changing and what my goals are, you know, okay, yes, hitting a list seems to be the thing that's out there. Okay. Especially if you're traditionally published, hitting the New York Times list, right, specifically, because there's other lists. I know you say today.
Many times. Yeah.
Right. New York Times has this, but New York Times is not a pure list. It's not a sales list. It's curated. There's so much that goes into it that it's like, should that even be a goal?
Yeah. And, and even though I haven't made the list, you know, I've been interviewed by them. I had my own little, you know, whatever it's called, whatever that article is called, behind the books or whatever. Carol Bell did a did a great article on me recently. So the name is known. The name Beverly Jenkins is known. And like I said, sometimes success can be measured in different ways. So, but yeah, I mean, we are held to a different kind of success, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, you can have the big time success with the list, or you can have success with a little boy who writes an article or writes a Black History report,
right,
you know, and references his grandmama's Miss Bell books. You know, that's right, a different kind of, and that's a soul stirring and soul lasting kind of mm-hmm. success.
Yeah. So now it seems like you are one of the people that writers coming up can look to and see and like, oh, she can do that. I can do that. I can write historical. I can, you know, break these barriers. You're definitely a trailblazer in that way. And, you know, especially like I'd never thought I was going to write historical. I was like, I'm not doing all that research. That's too hard.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh, but you can, there's so many, especially reading some of your books, showing different parts of history that I didn't know about, that I was inspired to go learn more about. It's like, well, there's things that we haven't seen that people need to know about. And that was very inspiring in those ways. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, as a trailblazer or as just a person who is now a model, mm-hmm. is writing hard? Do you ever face imposter syndrome?
Nope, I don't. You know, I was never raised to even know what imposter syndrome is. You know, from my elementary school teachers to my mama and my aunt, you know, I had 9 aunts. I got 21 first cousins. You know, and the ladies at church, nobody ever told me to be not dream. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever told me that you're not worthy of your dreams. So I look at all these people talking about imposter syndrome and I'm like, well, what the hell is that? You know, but I understand people, we were all raised differently. There's, you know, no right way to be raised. You know, there are wrong ways to be raised. But it never occurred to me to think I was not worthy to have people buy my books. So the answer is no. I've never suffered from, I got too big of an ego for that, I think. You know, it's like, you know, somebody once said, you know, writers must have huge egos in order to think that people are going to buy their books.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and in a way that's true. So for me, you know, how can you have the ego and not think you're worthy of this gift that you've been given? Because writing is a gift.
Yes.
That would be like, I don't know, John Batiste saying, well, you know, I don't want a Grammy because, you know, I don't think I'm a very good piano player. You know, it's like, what? You know?
Yeah.
So,
it's a huge contradiction. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. So, like I said, I understand, you know, that some people don't have that confidence. But my elementary school teachers put me on a stage in the fourth grade. You know, I never met a microphone I didn't like since then. So getting up and speaking and quote unquote teaching and writing are all part of that. It's like, get up and do your thing, girl. Show these people, you know, who you are and who you're representing and all that. And I'll be 73 in 2 weeks. And I think I'm still doing good. You know, I don't know. I don't, you know.
I think your readers agree with you.
Yeah. You know, what you see is what you get. You know, right. So, yeah.
Do you think about retiring from writing?
Yeah, I do. I do. But then I like, okay, I got one more story to write, you know.
They keep coming.
Yeah, they keep coming. They don't care how old I am. You know, I got a host of people. I call it in my brain, I call it my green room. And, you know, they're all up in there tapping their foot and tapping their watches going, well, when is it my turn, girl? You know.
Yeah.
I think when it's time for me to leave this world, you know, I tell people I'm going to be banging on the inside of the casket going, wait, I got another story to write. Wait a minute. I'm not ready yet. But I am seriously thinking about no longer touring though.
Mm.
Because you get to a certain age where it's hard to walk through airports and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in New York recently and LaGuardia almost killed me. You know, it's like, this is the improved LaGuardia. Can we have the old one back, please? You know, I almost died. But, it gave me a little chuckle because it wasn't just me. You know, young people were struggling too, trying to get, you know, to the luggage thing. So, but yeah, I may stop. This may be my last year of doing the road so hard because, you know, I've been a road warrior for, mm-hmm, so long, mostly because, you know, you don't get the support, you know, especially during the first parts of my career, I didn't get the support that,
right,
you know, you would expect.
Right.
From those people who were sending you contracts.
Yeah.
So you had to go out there and sell your pizza on your own.
There's a long tradition of that, you know. I went indie initially because of researching Oscar Michaud, the filmmaker,
okay,
early Black filmmaker who literally took his films in his car or whatever in the 1920s, you know, from,
yeah,
theater to theater.
Yeah.
And then I had a professor at Howard, Haile Gerima, who also took his films personally to theaters all across the country. So
yeah.
We know we have to sell our own work.
Yeah, we got to make it do what it do. Otherwise, you're just sitting at home, you know, crying or
being mad, right?
You know, yeah, when you take the bull by the horn and get on a mule and go. So, yeah.
So what advice would you have to younger authors, I mean, early career authors or aspiring authors about goal setting and ideas of success, like what their expectations should be in the industry?
You know, I think the only thing you can control is what you write. You know, so if your goal is to write a lot, you know, I think I got 60 books, which was like, what? Yeah, Iris Boland asked me one day last week, we were talking on the phone, she said, how many books do you have? And I was like, girl, I don't know, because I don't keep up with that kind of stuff. You know, some people count every book. I don't know. So she called me back a couple days later. She said, you got 60 books. She said, so when somebody asks you, say 60 books. I said, thank you, Iris. But, you know, I think you have to assess what you want out of your career. I mean, and we're all, I think we all measure success differently. Mm-hmm. I mean, don't fall into the hype of thinking that, you know, just because you make the New York Times list, that you're successful. Yeah, you're successful in that sense, but can you write another book?
Right.
And can you write another book after that? Can you write books for 30 years? And make enough pennies to at least be comfortable?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the goal. You know, can my writing, along with Social Security, pay a light bill? I mean, it's also a subjective kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But my base advice is to learn as much as you can about this business. You know, don't write a book and then say, well, what am I supposed to do next? You should know.
Mm-hmm.
You should know where to look. You might not know where to look, but there's always people out here who are going to help you. And then there are people out here who are going to steal your dreams. Mm-hmm. And you need to know the difference. Anybody that's asking you for money to represent them, that's a big ass red flag. Because money is supposed to flow to the author, not to the agent.
Right.
At least not personally.
Yeah.
I also tell them, finish the book. You know, a lot of people, I was included in that, just want to talk about, well, I'm writing a book. When are you going to finish it? As my sister and them used to say, well, how is the book doing? Because I have four sisters, you know, and they give me no break.
Right.
And that's good, you know. But, you know, learn as much about the business as you can. Finish the book. You are not in competition with other writers. The only person you're competing with is yourself.
Mm-hmm.
What did I say the other day? That there should be a class in how not to be a dumbass author.
I think a lot of authors need that class from things we're seeing on social.
and that was what it was. I think the first one was, I don't remember what the first one was. One was, don't create sock puppets. To dog out other authors.
Yeah.
Don't be a legend in your own mind. Don't solicit little girls to pose naked with your book. It's been a trip, hasn't it?
And we're
still in January.
I know, right? That was all this year, this month.
Yeah. Oh, I know that the last one, I can't remember what the first one was, but the last one was, don't make Queen Nora angry.
Somebody does that every year, it seems like.
Yeah, you do that at your own peril. But yeah, learn as much as you can about the business of writing, because that hopefully will save you some heartache. I send people to Jane Friedman's website.
Yeah.
Because she's so upfront about, you know, how this business works. She's willing to help. And she knows what she's talking about because, you know, she was a publisher and all of that, an editor and all that for years and years. So, and it's up to you to do the homework. You know, nobody's going to do it for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you go to Jane Friedman and you look around and find, you know, and you talk to other successful you know, writers.
Yeah.
You know, so, or maybe not successful, but somebody who knows their way around, who's been at this, and who's willing to help you. So, because most of the time, at least for romance, we try and get along. We try and be helpful. I think that was one of the biggest things about RWA was, you know, was craft. You know, we were the best teachers of craft. The rest of it was crap. That's why they had to burn that place down. I'm like, really? But they are still out here trying to, you know, restructure it and revive it and all that. And, you know, God bless them. But surround yourself with people who are like-minded and people who are supportive. So a lot of stuff.
Yeah, no, it's all important because we do this alone, and having people that can keep you from being an idiot that you can like, check with before you do something, before you make that post, just check in.
Yeah, call your girls, you know. Do your girls need to tell you to close the laptop.
Right.
Go outside and take some grass.
One more question. If someone calls you a successful author, how does that make you feel?
I don't know. I mean, like I said, it's part of that. How do you measure success? You know, if somebody calls me and says, I read your books to my mom in hospice, and it helped her transition. Or I have another woman on Twitter who said every time, and she's on the spectrum, and she said every time she loses it, she said, what brings her back are my books. So, like I said, it depends on how you define success. You know, how do you find success in a world that is so crazy right now? You find it for me in little ways, in those small moments, those moments where people find grace in what you write, the sister who earlier in my career who told me, Miss Bev, your books are wonderful. She said, I no longer sing Nobody Knows the Trouble. She said, when I get to the end of your books, I found success in when Indigo was published and all the dark-skinned women who were in tears because they had never been represented in that way before in their lives. So you can measure success by, you know, how many Cadillacs you own, or, you know, how many, I can measure mine by how many Dooney and Burke bags I got, but, you know, how many, you know, you measure success in a way that fills your heart, I think. And we're all different, but, you know, some people going to count how many Cadillacs they got. Right. You know, some people going to going to measure success by being, you know, an asshole to their fans. Because we've seen that. Mm-hmm. You know, you are never so successful that you cannot be kind to people who are paying your mortgage.
Right.
Yeah. You know, right. So anyway, that's my two cents.
Yeah. I love that because it's about authenticity. And that's another thing that I have been thinking and talking a lot about. It seems like your concern is the authenticity that you're putting into your books. Mm-hmm. And that touches people. Like, we all feel it, those of us who read the books.
Yeah.
And there's that kind of feedback loop there. So if you were, maybe if you had other goals, if you were chasing money, perhaps that more money would be there, but that authenticity and that connection would probably be lost.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the older you get, stuff changes in how you look at things, how you look at life, how you interact with people. I mean, you got to basically start out as being a kind person anyway, to begin with. Because some people just go the opposite and be all crotchety and all of that when they get old. But, you know, my philosophy is that it's better to be a blessing than to be a bitch. Mm-hmm. You know, and people can sense that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't ever want to be remembered for being unkind. The world is unkind enough without you adding to it. So, you know, be the drink of water on the desert, you know. So, yeah.
Thank you. This has absolutely helped me, and this is really why I'm doing it. But I think it's going to help lots of other people, too.
My shingle is always, you know, like Lucy, you know, 5 cents, you know, I'm always here.
Thank you so much for being here and talking to me, and I've had a wonderful time, and just an honor to speak to you, and I really appreciate it. Speaking with authors who I consider successful about their definitions of success is slowly helping me to reevaluate my own relationship with success. I absolutely love the confidence of someone who doesn't even understand imposter syndrome. One of my biggest takeaways from talking to Ms. Bev is what she said about, no one told me not to dream or not to be worthy of my dreams. Imposter syndrome, which is that feeling that you're not really supposed to be here and your achievements are sort of you pulling one over on everyone else, it's a state of mind that so many of us internalize. But it's really important to remember that it's optional. If we all just said to ourselves, I deserve to be here. I am worthy. I am a real author who deserves to live their dreams. What could that mindset shift do? If you're interested in learning more about Beverly Jenkins or reading her work, which I highly recommend, I have links in the show notes. You can also sign up for the Footnotes newsletter, which includes all of the show notes for every episode, as well as weekly inspiration, strategies, and ideas to help you grow as a writer and as a creative. And that is at myimaginaryfriends.net/footnotes. When you sign up, you can choose to become an imaginary best friend for a few dollars a month and get access to premium posts, quarterly workshops, as well as discounts on my courses and coaching. Next up in our interview series, I'm going to speak with multiple award-winning author, P. Jelly Clark. If you don't want to miss that, make sure you're subscribed. And until the next time, keep imagining.